It's showtime.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
You know, the right to bear arms is because that's the last form of defense against tyranny.
Washington is fundamentally corrupt. There are more words in the IRS code than there are in the Bible.
Made in America, heard round the world. You're listening to Blunt Force Truth. I'm Chuck Woolery, along with my co-host, Mark Young. And let me ask you a question. Yes. If you had 51 violations and 9 false statements with the FBI, what would they do to you? Well, John Solomon has found that that's how the FBI's rushes FISA. It had 51 violations and 9 false statements. The appendix shows. But they were just mistakes. You don't get to make mistakes with the FBI, but they can make mistakes with you. Now, my question is, why is it that all of these people in high places in government are never held accountable for their bad actions, but we are always held accountable for ours?
Because we're not part of the ruling class.
You know what? That pretty much sums it up, doesn't it?
That's exactly what it is.
And yet we elect people to hire these people and give them jobs, and they use our government against us. I mean, give me a break.
They're the ruling class. We are not the ruling class. So maybe you and I need to run for office.
Well, yeah, right, and become part of the ruling class. Yeah, that's what I want in my life. I don't want to rule over people. I have no desire to do that. Neither do you, really, do you?
No. I was literally formally asked to run for Congress about 3-4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
By people in the Republican Party. And my comment was, well, I'm very, you know, very flattered you think I'd be a good congressperson. No.
Not, and people always say, if you want to change the government, then get in it and change it. Yeah, right.
I think we can affect more change where we're at.
Donald Trump's trying to change the government. Look how he's treated. Oh, my gosh.
Chuck, I'm going to break into the show right now because I want to tell people about something that is freaking amazing.
What is that?
This is called H2 Max.
Oh, let me ask you, is this that thing you take for to get a suntan or something like that?
No, you do not take this for a suntan.
What is it? Okay, I'm just curious.
H2 Max, Chuck, are tablets that you drop in water. They are molecular hydrogen.
Oh.
Now, I want to tell you what this is about. I have the research, and I am so excited about this because this is a product that's going to change people's lives.
Really?
It is. So H2 Max is hydrogen. Now, hydrogen is what the universe is made out of. The sun is a ball of hydrogen. Our bodies need hydrogen, but we don't get the levels of hydrogen that we need.
Why?
Because we don't have a source for it. I mean, we have water, but when you put a hydrogen tablet in the water, you now have water that has a super amount of hydrogen in it.
Okay.
So you take a tablet, you drop it in water, you let it dissolve. It kind of bubbles up like an Alka-Seltzer. You drink the water down. Now make sure if you use this, only use a glass or a metal container. Never put it in plastic or in paper because the hydrogen, those molecules are so tiny, they'll actually go right through the sides of the vessel. Here's what it does, Chuck. When you take something like Motrin, you've used Motrin before.
Mm-hmm.
So Motrin, I'm going to get a little science-y on you here. Motrin is what's called a COX-2 inhibitor. It takes an enzyme that our body makes called COX-2, and our body makes this enzyme which causes inflammation. So when you take a Motrin, you're stopping that, you're inhibiting that from happening, okay? H2 Max, by using hydrogen, it down-regulates or actually gets your body to stop making the COX-2 enzyme that causes inflammation and pain. So you don't even have to take some kind of serious medication to get rid of it.
And by the way, I have a little bit of a kidney problem. And correct. I can't take Motrin, I can't take Tylenol, I can't take any of that stuff. So I have to suffer through this, but I can use that. That's interesting.
You can use this. Now, H2 Max, besides for down-regulating this COX-2, it also interrupts the nerve pathways in the body that tells the brain you're in pain. So it actually helps turn off pain signals. I got to tell you, now I've taken this. you and I have a mutual friend. I'm going to tell you, I won't use a name right now, but you and I have a mutual friend who's 60 years old this month, and he's been racing motocross since he was 12.
Yes.
You know who I'm talking about.
Yep.
And he is so crippled up from breaking every bone in his body.
Right.
That when he gets up in the morning, it takes him about 2 hours to actually get out the door to go work. I was sitting in a restaurant with him, and he was telling me, he goes, I'm almost ready to start sobbing. I'm in so much pain right now. I was on my motorcycle, and I had a bottle of H2 Max in the motorcycle. I went out and got it. I put three of them in a glass of water. Took about 2 minutes. I said, here, drink this. In 10 minutes, he stood up and he started crying. He goes, I'm not hurting. He goes, oh my God, I haven't felt like this in 20 years.
Really?
He now lives on this product.
Well, this would be great for pro athletes, people like that, people who are athletes who have, you know, had problems.
Oh, it's huge for athletes.
Yeah.
So folks, I want to tell you, if you are
somebody, this is perfectly natural.
100%, no side effects.
Mm-hmm.
If you or
H2 Max.
H2 Max. And if you're suffering with pain, chronic pain, you know someone that is, or you want to be able to get a bigger workout in and have less pain after even exercise.
Where do you get H2 Max? I
want you to go to buyh2max.com. Okay. That's buyh2max.com. Try it out. And please, please contact us and tell us what your experience is. We want to hear about it.
Now, do you know what the dosage is? I mean, you say you gave Al three of them. I said his name, but nobody, I didn't know his last name anyway. You gave Al three of them. So do they normally, would you normally take three or two or one or what?
So if you're using it for exercise and fitness and you just want to get a better workout in, use one. If you're somebody that's dealing with some arthritis pain, things of that nature, try two. You can use up to five in one glass of water, but try two. If you don't think I'm quite getting what I want, then go for a third one. Mm-hmm. Find your dose. Here's the other thing, Chuck, is even if you have to use two or three in the morning, most people will get 6 to 8 hours of relief. So in most cases, they'll take two or three in the morning, and they'll take one in the afternoon or one in the evening or one, you know, so they'll do one, you know, two in the morning and one in the afternoon or evening.
Right.
Just to keep it maintained. But folks, try this stuff. It's a really good question you brought up about the dosing. And again, it's hydrogen. You can't hurt yourself. So you can take up to five of these at one time and nothing bad's going to happen. Try this stuff. I cannot tell you how amazing this is, and please let us know what happens.
All right. That sounds great. H2 Max.
All right. So, Chuck, we have a special guest with us today. We're going to say Professor H.W. Brands. We're going to refer to him as Bill. Let me give you a little background here, folks. Professor Brands is just an absolute scholar on history, especially American history. And you're going to catch up with that. We're going to talk about some of his books. And today we're going to focus on his most recent book, which is Dreams of El Dorado. But there's something about your past that caught my attention. And that is, you earned your college degree while selling cutlery across America?
Well, actually,
I bought some of that cutlery, by the way. I'm not sure it was from you.
It was my first job out of college.
Out of college. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you were selling like Cutco knives or?
Not Cutco. We had high quality stuff.
Oh, great. I'm the one who bought the Cutco crap.
So it's knives and scissors, basically. Yeah. And my territory spanned from Portland in Oregon to Denver in Colorado. And
that's
in fact,
a pretty
that's
big
one
territory.
Of the reasons I wrote this book on the American West, because a very large part of the West was territory that I was driving across on a regular basis.
So let me ask you something. I have a couple of things on my mind that I really want to drill down on just a little bit. In the election of 2012, Hillary Clinton came out and said something. Someone said, you're a liberal. And she said, no, not really. I'm more of a progressive. And it was the first time I had heard the word progressive. I'd never heard it before in my life. And so do me a favor. Can you take me, how long has progressivism been around And Democrats have denied the fact that they're progressives. They're really liberal. And now they're back to being progressives.
The term first entered American politics in the 1890s. And it referred to people who believed that the Industrial Revolution had knocked things in American politics out of balance. It created this very large, this very wealthy class of monopolists who were undermining democracy by attaining excessive political power as a result of their excessive economic power. The progressives were drawn from both political parties. They were heirs of the populists of the 1890s. The populists were a reform movement or a protest movement with mostly farmers. The progressives were different in that they were mostly middle-class type people. They were mostly city dwellers. They were fairly well-educated. And they believed that the solution to the problems of democracy was more democracy. So it's to the progressives that we owe primary elections, for example. It's that we owe initiatives and referendums at the state level. To the progressives, we owe the direct election of senators.
17th Amendment.
Exactly. So these amendments were things that were going to improve democracy. The progressive movement.
Now, let me interrupt you just a minute, because you keep saying democracy, as most people do. And I really believe that's a term of the left, the way it's used. The founding fathers hated democracy.
The founding fathers were suspicious of democracy because they didn't believe that ordinary people could run their own affairs.
Well, he said it was the most vile form of government known to man. That's what Madison said.
Yeah, that was for rhetorical purpose. And in fact, he got adjusted to the idea. So they were basically all educated in the aristocratic politics of Britain. I mean, this was their background.
Right.
And what they were struggling for in the American Revolution was home rule. It wasn't the kind of revolution that the French started in 1789.
Well, they didn't know that at the time until it kind of progressed and they went, oh, no, this is not it.
Well, exactly.
I mean, Jefferson.
This is one of the things that made them suspicious of it. But democracy became part of American political culture by the election of Andrew Jackson in 1828. And this because Americans became a more egalitarian society. And Americans simply demanded, ordinary Americans demanded participation in politics. So by the time Jackson became senator, this idea of democracy had become fairly well rooted. Now, it was rooted at the grassroots first. But by the 1850s and 1860s, it was something that both political parties embraced. And so Abraham Lincoln was a firm advocate of American democracy, besides being a founding father of the modern Republican Party.
Now, it's kind of difficult for people to understand the difference between a republic and a republic, small d, democracy. It's very hard to kind of wrap your head around, because all the states, all the elections for state senator, for national senators, for Congress people, those are all Democratic elections. But the presidential election is a completely different thing.
Well, it's a somewhat different thing. It's not as completely different as the founding fathers intended it to be.
Well, it's the Electoral College, which is not, it's not direct democracy.
Right, except that the electors these days are pretty much bound by the vote of the people of their states. At the beginning, the electors weren't supposed to be bound by anything. They were bound only by their consciences. And so it was, the electors were no more bound at the beginning than a senator today. So if you elect a senator from Ted Cruz, doesn't right. have to poll the people of Texas to determine which way he's going to vote. He votes his conscience or his principles or something like that. And that's the way the electors were supposed to operate. But by the middle, and furthermore, in the beginning, the electors were chosen not by the people of the states, they were chosen by the legislatures of the states.
And they were answerable to the legislature too, weren't they?
That's right. And this because the framers of the Constitution were distrustful of the ability of ordinary people to make a good judgment. They felt they would get carried away by demagogues who would promise them the moon and wouldn't be able to deliver.
That kind of happened.
Things changed over time, so that by the middle of the 19th century, both political parties had acknowledged that, whether we like it or not, this is the way of the world. The American Republic was founded in opposition to the British monarchy.
Right.
So the original understanding of republic is that power emanates from the people, but it's very unspecific as to which people and exactly how the power emanates.
Well, how is our democracy different than Soviet democracy or Iranian democracy or Afghani? Well,
because in those places, the people, the votes don't actually count at all. They're simply eyewash. And nobody believes that when you voted for Stalin and he got 98% of the vote, nobody took that seriously.
So yeah, he said it didn't matter how many votes you get. The guys who counted the votes are the ones who counted.
Yeah. And so in American democracy, as in the democracies of most other countries that are actually democracies, votes do count. It's an imperfect system. They don't all count equally. In the United States, we are basically the only modern democracy that has anything like an electoral college, where there is this last filter. And the reason for this is the American democracy was not, as you point out, it was not founded as a democracy. It evolved into a democracy out of a previous and different set of assumptions. The other thing is, in 1800, there were basically no democracies in the world, maybe Switzerland on good days. By 1900, there were perhaps 8, 10, a dozen democracies. By 2000, there were probably 120 democracies. So this idea has caught on. Now, does that mean in 2050 or 2100, every place is going to be a democracy? That's really hard to say. There's been some backsliding among places that 20 years ago kind of looked democratic. But there had been this long belief emerging out of America's political experience that democracy was the inevitable direction of political evolution. And on the basis of 200 years, you know, that's not a bad guess.
Do you think, I mean, there's so many people in the Democrat Party, several anyway, that are running for president, that are claiming they're going to get rid of the Electoral College when they become president. Do you think that's a good idea?
I think it's a good idea. I don't think it's going to happen. And it falls in the category of...
So you think it would have been a good idea if Hillary was elected instead of Trump?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. But the thing is that... And this falls in the category of if the Electoral College didn't exist today, it would not occur to anybody to invent it. It really is this vestige of an earlier time. And because it gives greater weight to the votes of people in smaller states, and because there are more smaller states than there are large states, and because 3/4 of the states are required to amend the Constitution, we're basically stuck with the Electoral College. So there's not going to be an amendment that's going to do away with the Electoral College.
I agree with you. But if we did get rid of the Electoral College, then wouldn't we basically be handing over, presidential elections to California, New York, Texas, and wouldn't a lot of states really not be that relevant anymore?
Well, yes and no. But the thing is, the voting would not take place by states. And so no one would say, Texas went for this candidate. They would say, in Texas, this candidate got X votes and the other candidate got Y votes. But a vote in Texas would be equal to a vote in Wyoming. And so the elections, the returns wouldn't be reported by state. They would simply be reported, okay, this is how many votes one candidate got, this is how many votes the other candidate got. Just as in votes for governors of the states, people don't wait to see how Houston voted to see who's going to be the governor of Texas. They count up the precincts and that sort of thing. But there aren't these essentially arbitrary subdivisions within the state. Every vote within the state of Texas for governor counts equally. Without the Electoral College, every vote for the president of the United States would count equally.
Well, that's what I said. All states are pure democracies.
Pardon?
All state elections are pure democracies.
Pretty much.
Well, congressional, senatorial, I mean.
Yeah, but
legislative.
I mean, the thing to remember is that we also, every state and the United States has a Bill of Rights. So there are these areas carved out that Congress can't go where the state legislatures can't go. So a pure democracy would be the majority rules on everything. But the majority can't say, I don't like your political opinions, and therefore shut up or go to jail. I mean, that's why we have a Bill of Rights. And so we are this somewhat constrained democracy. But it is true that in this country, the only elected office that is not by direct vote of the people is the presidency. And of course, the vice president who goes along with it.
So now I want to ask you a future question, because I have a feeling how most historians will look at this. So Trump is going to be impeached, probably, by the House. You've seen the articles of impeachment. How do you think history is going to look back on this event?
Clearly the Senate is going to nullify
just the event itself, the fact that it's come about.
Well, okay, it's a big deal because it's only the third time this has happened in American history, where it's gone this far. And so there have been 44 presidents, and 3 out of 44, that means that the current president, President Trump, is one of the small group. So that will get the attention of historians. But will they pay any more attention to this than historians until now have paid attention to the impeachment of Bill Clinton? That depends on what happens. Now, at the moment, it looks like Donald Trump will not be removed from office upon conviction by the Senate. Looks like that's not going to happen. So if that doesn't happen, then it will look sort of like the impeachment and acquittal of Bill Clinton. But part of the same question is, does Trump get reelected in 2020? If he gets reelected, then historians will immediately consider Donald Trump to be one of the dozen or so most important presidents in American history. Because there's the category of, if you get reelected, that puts you in a different echelon than just getting elected the first time. Because what it says is that the American people reviewed your performance and gave you a thumbs up. People get elected the first time on the promise. They get elected the second time on the performance. So Donald Trump was elected in 2016 as this wild card. Nobody knew exactly what values he would govern by, what kind of president he would be. And so there have been odd candidates who occasionally sneak in the first time. But to get reelected, that's a big deal. So if he gets reelected, then it will mean that things have changed, that what Americans expect of their presidents is different from what it had been before.
So they will validate him instead of validating impeachment?
Yeah, you could put it that way. I mean, yeah, assuming that he doesn't get removed from office.
Now, when you say he'll become one of the most important presidents in history, is that surely because of the reelection or because of being reelected after an impeachment?
No, it's surely because of the reelection. Yeah.
Okay.
And in fact, that will be, I mean, because he's almost certainly not going to get convicted, that's going to be a much bigger deal than the trial in the Senate and the impeachment by the House. Because it's really clear, I mean, we live in a time when politics is partisan. So people who think that Donald Trump ought to be removed from office, well, they agree with what the House is doing, and that's that. And people who don't think Trump ought to get removed from office, Republicans, they're going to think that he shouldn't be removed from office.
Well, both know that there are many Republicans, Mitch McConnell included, who really never liked Trump.
Oh, there's no question about this.
And yet they seem like they're going to stay on board and coalesce around each other, which Republicans never do, and probably not vote for his impeachment.
Yeah, well,
I find that interesting.
If you were simply a mainstream Republican and you ask yourself what has been accomplished during the Trump presidency, you're fairly happy with that. Because leave aside the theatrics.
Just to build on that, if I'm a Republican and I'm happy, why wouldn't I be happy as a Democrat for what he's built and what he's accomplished over the last 3 years? Because everything that he's accomplished has been positive. I mean, my God, the economy is off the rails. I mean, it's amazing what he has accomplished in 3 years. I would think that American citizens, Democrats or Republicans, would be equally happy with their lives and looking back at what he's accomplished.
Well, okay, so if you're a Democrat, you would say he gave this windfall to the rich. He has reduced access to health care for the poor. He has made life really tough for immigrants. He has essentially...
Well, illegal immigrants or immigrants? I hate to conflate the two.
No, and so if you're a Democrat, I mean, this is one thing that the Democrats as a party don't spend much time doing, distinguishing between those who have a right to be here and those who don't.
Agreed.
And this is definitely a weak part of the Democratic platform, their policy. But I'm speaking, if you're a Democrat, here's why you would like to see Donald Trump removed from office. Mm-hmm. And he has run up an enormous debt after promising to bring the debt down. This is something that Republicans have gotten away with since Ronald Reagan. And he has attacked regulations that preserve consumer safety and the environment. He's gone in the wrong direction on climate change. So if you're a Democrat, these are all things simply in terms of policy that you don't like about Donald Trump. Now, leave aside the issues on which he's being impeached. If you're a Democrat, you take those very seriously and think he ought to be removed from office on that grounds as well. Removed from office either by the Senate or in the election of 2020. But the striking thing about the period we live in, and this, the reason that the impeachment process is so comparatively uninteresting, is that pretty much everybody knows that no minds are being changed by the evidence that's being unearthed and put forward.
Well, I mean, abuse of power and
they're pretty nebulous.
Obstruction of Congress. I mean, that's pretty weak.
The only people that anybody's battling for right now are independents in the middle. The left is going to be the left. The right is going to be the right. Nobody's mind is being changed. But there's some relatively disinterested people in the middle who might start to look at this as we get closer to the election. And as a historian, you probably know this. If we go back to the revolutionary days, didn't we have about a third of the population who wanted to stay with the crown, a third that wanted to have the revolution, and a third that really was in the middle and didn't care?
That's what John Adams said. He was just guessing. So nobody knows.
Right. Gallup wasn't around yet.
So. Well, most polls today are just guessing too. So.
Well, at least they actually talked to people. And Adams didn't talk to anybody. Right. But in terms of this question of the independents, in reality, there are very few people who are independent in the sense that in one presidential election year, they'll vote for a Democrat, and the next election year, they might vote for a Republican. They call themselves independents because they're so fed up with the political parties that they don't want to call themselves a Democrat or a Republican. But in fact, they pretty much vote with the Democrats all the time.
I understand that. That makes perfect sense. Right. I call myself a conservative because I don't want to be called a Republican or a Democrat.
Right. But the question is, will they turn out? The question is, who's going to turn out? And that will probably provide the basis for the decision in 2020. And so this is the basis for the political strategies of the two parties. It's not that they're trying to change minds. It's they're going to get their people to turn out. And it's not simply get their so-called base to turn out. If they can get their, as the ones you describe as the moderates in the middle, if you can get them to turn out, then you have a chance. The other thing about American politics, the striking thing about American politics, especially at the presidential level, but pretty much throughout, is how close the races almost always are. In American presidential history, no president, leaving aside George Washington and James Monroe when he ran unopposed in 1820, has ever gotten more than 61% of the vote. And it's a landslide lately if you get 53% of the vote. And so all that means is that, you know, 45% is solidly in one camp, 45% is solidly in the other camp. And the only question is, where is that middle 10% going to go? How's that going to break? And it's not all going to go to one side or the other. And so this is one of the reasons why politics is the way it is. And it's one of the reasons why there are plenty of conservatives who disagree very much that Donald Trump has done. I mean, you can start with the fact that one of the pillars of conservative politics since World War II has been free trade. And, you know, when Donald Trump has attacked free trade and launched the tariff war, now, I speak as a historian who in 2016 published a book on the, I guess it was 2017. Anyway, it was after Donald Trump got inaugurated. And it was a book about American politics in the early 19th century when the tariff was a hot issue. And when I was writing the book, I thought people were unfortunately going to be bored about this issue because no one today has ever heard of tariffs. Tariffs sort of went out the window after the Second World War. But Donald Trump brought tariffs right back into things. But this is something that really cuts against everything, all the free market philosophy of conservatives.
You know,
Donald Trump is a vote getter, they've been willing to go along with it. And in politics, you always accept something less than perfect in the interest of getting closer to the goal you're aiming for.
I remember when Trump was running, he was talking about tariffs, and Karl Rove and I happened to meet each other down in Austin. We were both doing Fox News on different programs. And he and I were talking about this, and I said, you know, the problem is he sounds a lot like Hoover, and good Lord, I have no interest in it. He's, I agree with this whole tariff thing that he keeps talking about scares me. And yet, as we look back on what's happened with tariffs, they become a pretty good lever to get what you want. No, it seems.
He hasn't gotten anything out of China. He hasn't gotten anything.
Well, not China, but I think in a lot of other places, he's gotten a lot of stuff.
But the, one of the things that the advocates of tariffs rarely mention is who's paying for these things. It's America. Well,
American people normally do. The country that imposes tariffs, normally their people usually pay for it.
Well, that's it. They're consumers. We pay high prices. To the extent that tariffs are actually put into effect, we pay high prices. That's what a tariff is. It's an
It hasn't really happened. Have you noticed that?
Well, that's the thing. And that's why I have to say, with when you evaluate Donald Trump, you have to distinguish the political theater from the stuff that has actually taken place. If you just look at the changes in policies, things that have become law, they're not that different from what Jeb Bush as president would have put into effect. And this is why Republicans, even if they might find Donald Trump very distasteful, they're willing to put up with him. And you know, this happens on both sides. So people who thought that Bill Clinton, you know, was this really sleazy guy, but he was a Democrat and he governed as a Democrat. And if you're a Democrat, you hold your nose and you say, okay, I'd rather have Bill Clinton be president than another term of George H.W. Bush or Bob Dole.
And I think what we're going to see in 2020 when we look at it is Trump is doing an awesome job of energizing his own base. He really knows how to do that. Then I think you're going to have a group of people who are going to say, I don't really like this guy. I'm kind of offended by him, but I like my 401k and I like that I've got a job. And the other side's kind of frightening me because of all this socialism talk. So I'm probably just going to stick with this right now because this other stuff frightens me.
Well, I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
But the other thing I was going to say is, and please comment, I don't think the Democrats as of this point have put up a candidate who's equally as exciting as he is.
Yes and no. I would say that at this point of the 2015-2016 election cycle, nobody knew what the Republicans were doing either. When you start with a really large field, it takes a while for one candidate to come out. And then Absolutely. When the Democrats finally nominate somebody, then okay, this is the one we're going to focus on. One of the striking things, though, about President Trump is how low his approval rating is for how well the country is doing. So the economy has not done this well since the 1920s. And his approval rating ought to be in the 50s. At least, but it never.
Do you think the media has any part in that?
In both directions. I think the media keeps his rating as high as it is, but it also keeps it as low as it is. So the conservative media applauds Donald Trump for everything he does. And so the things that Democrats don't like about him often don't get much reported in the conservative media, and vice versa. If you're watching MSNBC, then you're going to hear a liberal slant on things. And Trump's not going to get much credit for the stuff that he has done. And so this is one of the reasons that opinions and partisan positions don't move much, because people on the left of the political spectrum, they're not very open to new information from the right side and vice versa. And it's very easy to live in your own news, your own media universe. And you don't have to, you don't actually see the information, you don't see the evidence that the other side is seeing.
You know, it's interesting because doing what we do, Mark and I think about the conservative media, which is basically radio, talk radio, and Fox News. There's not a whole lot more of the media for the conservative side of things. And the Democrat side, it's ABC, NBC, CBS, all the cable channels, with the exception of Fox News. And so I try to watch everything and digest what they're saying, how they're saying it. And I must tell you something. I watch CNN, MSNBC. It's like a world that I can't even grasp. I mean, it's so far. It's like they live in a whole different universe.
But
it's like the world's turned upside down, and I watch it all the time. I constantly watch and listen to them. And it sounds like there's no basis for what they say. It's just they say it in order to get viewers to watch or clicks or whatever. It's amazing to me.
Well, as a consumer of news.
Now, I realize I'm biased.
Well, right. I mean, as a consumer of news, people have to distinguish between reporting that is supported by evidence and opinion that's supported by nothing. Now, in fact, most of the news networks are mostly opinion.
Exactly. Disguised as news.
And opinions are cheap. And so, you know, I read the Wall Street Journal, I read the New York Times, I read the Washington Post, and I'm not going to call myself a particularly sophisticated consumer of the media, but I do pay attention to, okay, is this statement supported by fact? And if it is, then that's worth more than if it's just somebody's opinion that's not supported by anything in particular.
But you're obviously much more discerning.
Well, it is my business.
Assumption, right.
I mean, this is what I do. Yeah.
So let me ask you a media question, and I want to get into your newest book. What would you account for when we look at the ratings of a Fox News versus CNN and MSNBC? We see that Fox News, their audience levels are infinitely larger than CNN and MSNBC. How would you account for that? Would you account for it as being because they're the only outfit, the only news outlet that's conservative, or that conservative values are a little stronger in the world, in the America, than the liberal values?
I haven't really thought about this much, but my first response would be that the media outlets that you've identified as liberal, there's several of them, they split the market. Whereas Fox News has the conservative market pretty much to itself when it comes to 24-hour news channels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. So let's talk about Dreams of El Dorado. Tell us a little bit about this book.
It's a book about a history of the American West, and it covers the American West from the Mississippi River west to the Pacific Ocean. It covers the period from the beginning of the 19th century with the Louisiana Purchase, 1803, which for the first time gives the United States legal title to land west of the Mississippi River. And I carry the story forward to the beginning of the 20th century. And I do this because the 19th century is the period where this American West is distinctive. It's different from the American East. I stop when I get to the beginning of the 20th century because by then, the American West is starting to look like the American East. And it no longer has those distinctive characteristics. So it's a region and a period that's identified by exploration, that's identified by the exploitation of opportunities to basically privatize resources that are in the public domain and put them into the private domain. And the best example of this is California Gold Rush. All that gold was public property, and people went to California and grabbed it and put it in their pocket, and then it was theirs.
So we've discussed something on this show before, and I want to get your opinion on it. And it has been that when we look at the American experiment, when we look at Europeans coming over to America, starting on the East Coast, the push westward, what would be your thoughts on the premise that I've made is part of what made America grow so rapidly and part of what became that American frontier and that American experience was the fact that we had the combination of freedom and free land, that had we not had that ability to have the freedom and that exploration and the free land, we wouldn't have had the explosion as a country that we did have. Because obviously there was no free land in Europe at that point, only here. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so one of the big appeals of America to immigrants from Europe is precisely that land was cheap in America. And that meant that the returns to labor were greater in America than they were in Europe. You could come to America and you could, if you were a casual laborer, you could triple your pay overnight. If you were a farmer, you had access to land. In most cases, you had to pay for the land, but the price of land was a very small fraction of what it was in Europe. So the main thing was that America had resources that were, I won't say free for the taking, because they weren't free, it, with some exceptions like the gold in California. But they were there. When you identify it as free land, yeah, so it was sort of free land, but the land, and a very large part of my story is, the land was already occupied by people who didn't want to give it away. And so one of the main themes of 19th century Western history is the struggle for control of Western land and other Western resources. And the struggle took the form of Indian wars that persisted for decades. Also a struggle over, for example, in the California gold fields, who gets to claim the land first? The reason it was called the California Gold Rush is that at first, the first people who got there just got to claim the land. And they did it because there was no law to say they couldn't. It was essentially outlaw territory in the very basic meaning of that term. It was outside the law. So another big story of this, another thing that distinguishes the West in 1800 from the West in 1900, in the West in 1800, there was no law in the West. It was pretty much outside the law. And that's, I mean, and some people equated that with freedom. We can go out to the West and do whatever we want, and there's nothing that anybody says to stop us from doing it. But it's because there were no governments. There were no territorial governments. There were no state governments. By 1900, the whole region of the West was occupied by state governments, or in a couple places still, territorial governments. So that's a large part of the story. Also, the population of the West grew dramatically during that period because people moved out to the West to take advantage of these opportunities.
So when all of these guys from the East started moving West and looking at everything, they get to California and they find out that there are these enormous hundreds of thousands of acres of ranches that have been owned by families out of Mexico for 100 years or more, and passed down and passed down. And that was just blown apart. They just took them out.
So the United States acquired title to California at the end of the war with Mexico. It lasted from 1846 to 1848.
Excuse me for interrupting, but the thing I'm asking is, since these guys owned all of these landowners owned all of this land in California that were Mexicans, did Mexican law affect them at all? Were they part of Mexico? Were they?
So the treaty that ended the war said that the United States law would now honor land titles acquired under Mexican law.
And those are the places I'm talking about.
Okay, you ranch owners, you get to keep your land. Mm-hmm. In fact, it didn't happen that way. And lawyers were brought in to contest the treaty and contest the terms, so that the big California landowners, who were Californios, these were Californians of Mexican descent, right, most of them had lost most of their land within 10 or 20 years.
Interesting.
How did that happen? How did they end up losing it?
In many cases, the land titles, as they were given under Mexican law, didn't conform with land titles under American law. And so somebody coming in could contest whether the title actually existed. And the courts that were adjudicating cases were now American courts. And there was quite common and open bias against the Mexicans who were there. And the thinking on the part of many of the new arrivals was, hey, we fought this war against Mexico and we won. Mexico lost. And part of the winnings ought to be that we ought to get the land. The land shouldn't stay with these Mexicans. And it wasn't simply Mexicans. So one of the largest land owners, I should say, one of the largest land holders in California was John Sutter. He was Swiss by birth. He was the guy who had contracted to build the sawmill that James Marshall was building when he discovered gold. And the thing about Sutter's land holdings was that he didn't actually have title to the land. A lot of people in California acted as though they had title to land when they didn't have title to the land, even under Mexican law. It's just that there was nobody there to contest it. It was very much like a situation that Theodore Roosevelt encountered in Dakota Territory when he tried to become a ranchman in Dakota. He ran up against people who had been grazing cattle on the public domain for years. They didn't own the land. They just got there first. They acted as though it was their land, and they tried to run him off, sending gunslingers after him. And this was the way they enforced their title to the land, but it wasn't a title that would hold up in court. So that was part of the issue. in California as well.
Now, Chuck, you may remember this, and I'll ask Professor Brands. So some relatives or family that in our family was the Doheny family.
Right.
So my uncle's grandfather actually got a land grant in the title to the La Brea Tar Pits, which is where his wealth really was built in the oil world, which really came, that really came right on the heels of that gold rush kind of timetable.
Yeah. So the philosophy of the American government in the 19th century regarding the public domain is we want to privatize this as quickly as possible. The government did not want to be in the business of being a big landholder or holder of timber or holder of oil or gold or other minerals. So the idea was it ought to go to the people as quickly as possible. This was the basis for the Homestead Act. And the reason this happened in the West and not in the East was in the East, private individuals already had title to nearly all the land. But the entire West, nearly the entire West, was acquired by the federal government before any private individuals had title to the land. So the entire West started out as federal property. And it seemed in 1800, in 1840, in 1860, in 1880, that this public domain in the West was essentially infinite. And so we can give it away as fast as we can, give it away to the American people because they're the owners of it after all. It was only by the end of the 19th century that people realized, well, wait a minute, maybe this is not the best stewardship of this land. And so when nearly the last buffalo had been killed, where there had been 15 million buffalo 30 years before, people began to think, well, you know, maybe this isn't the way to do it. When the gold diggings in California created erosion that flooded the farmers' fields of the Sacramento Valley, then people think, maybe we ought to go at this a little bit more slowly. Maybe there's a better way of doing this.
Now, Chuck, I should say, the Doheny families were originally East Coast. Mm-hmm. And Patrick's grandfather actually went bankrupt as an entrepreneur in the East Coast, and he actually headed to California to take part in the gold rush. That was really why he went to California, and the gold rush thing didn't work out, but then he started making smudge pots out of tar at the La Brea Tar Pit and started selling those to miners and railroaders for lighting.
So one of the striking things about the Western movement is it was a movement that wasn't participated in by the rich, and it wasn't participated in by the very poor. If you're very poor, you didn't have enough money to buy a wagon or whatever you needed to get west. If you're really rich, well, you didn't bother going west because things were going fine elsewhere. Right. So one of the striking things about the West was it had this sort of filtering effect on American society. The upper crust, the top 10% didn't go west, and the bottom 10% didn't go west. And what went west was this large middle group. And it's one of the reasons that democracy, to get back to the topic that we had at the very beginning, emerged first in the West. Because in the West, people really were more equal than they were in the East. If you lived in Virginia, if you lived in Boston, there were the rich folks and there were the poor folks. If you lived in Wyoming, if you lived in Oregon, there weren't rich folks and there weren't really poor folks. And so everybody was much more alike. And the idea of political equality seemed much more plausible in the West. There was one other thing, and that was that the Western states were all in competition, one with the other, for people coming. Because if you're starting a business in San Francisco, you want all the new population to come to San Francisco and not to Los Angeles. And when gold was discovered in California, then shopkeepers in Portland, Oregon were dismayed because everybody was leaving Oregon. Oregon was depopulated. They all went to California. So in order to entice people to one state rather than another, the state governments asked themselves, what can we give away that won't cost us anything? Ah, the right to vote. So we'll give people the right to vote. We'll give women the right to vote. Wyoming was the first state to allow women the right to vote. Because
I didn't know that.
Women, and one of the reasons for this is that in the West, women really did pull their weight in an obvious way. They didn't in the East.
Interesting.
Still true of my wife today.
She's a fine Texas woman.
That's right.
So does any of this play into how population bases have turned out now? I mean, why California has the enormous population that it has?
California essentially was born as a state of the United States and as the most cosmopolitan state in the Union. People went to California to hunt California gold from all over the world. And so California is a state that more than other states is very comfortable with the idea of people from all over the place looking, you know, all sorts of different ways, subscribing to different religions, speaking different languages and all this. That's a part of it. Another part of it is, and one of the things that I discovered in writing this history of the West is something I knew being a Westerner, but nonetheless, is there is a lot of mythology that surrounds the West. In fact, if you think of the most enduring myths of America, many of them are associated with the West. So the myth of the rugged individual, the myth of the cowboy, the myth of the cowboy is great. If you think of an iconic figure in American history, if you go to Europe and you ask Europeans, you ask Germans, so what's an American look like? You know, what's the archetype of American? They'll come up with a cowboy.
Ed.
And there's nothing like it that you see in the East.
And the life of a cowboy was probably miserable.
Well, yeah. I mean, the cowboy was basically a farmhand who sat on a horse.
Right.
And, I mean, the cowboys, this is not a romantic existence, except in the sense that nobody was directly supervising the cowboy. And that's where the myth of the cowboy comes from. This idea of the lone figure. It also has something to do with being on horseback. The cowboy is the knight in shining armor of American history. We don't actually have knights in armor, but we do have cowboys on horseback. And so there is that. But the striking thing about this is that the moment of the cowboy was very brief in even Western history. So the cowboy we think of is the cowboy driving the cattle on the long drive to the railhead or something like this. That lasted for about one decade, from the end of the Civil War to the moment when railroads got to Texas. The reason they drove the cattle hundreds of miles was not because cattle liked the exercise, and neither did the cowboys. The railroads hadn't gotten to Texas yet.
Right.
And the only way you could get those millions of longhorn cattle to the slaughterhouses of Chicago was to walk them to the railroads in Kansas and then put them on the railroads and off they go. Once the railroads got to Kansas, once the railroad got to Texas, then the long drive was all over. But nonetheless, that image of the cowboy sticks in a mind. Another myth that comes from the West is the myth of American individualism, the rugged individualism Americans we pride ourselves on. And like a lot of myths, there's a kernel of truth here, and then there's stuff that is added to this. And this myth of American individualism is strongest in the West, because these Westerners, and like the cowboy, were out there, or the fur trapper, the mountain man, the person who's, you know, dealing with the wilderness and bad weather and all this other stuff out on his own, which is true enough as far as it goes. But one of the striking things is that all of this was taking place on public land. And the Western states, the Western enterprises, they were all creatures of the federal government. There would have been no American West if not for the actions of the federal government of the United States.
So when did Theodore Roosevelt pretty much take all the land in the West that had minerals and was really worth something and put it under government control?
Well, while he was president, and he was very concerned as a hunter. Interestingly enough, the earliest conservation groups, and to this day,
the
strongest conservation groups are hunters and fishermen.
Right.
And Roosevelt went out to the West because he was dying to shoot and kill a buffalo. And he got the last buffalo within 100 miles of Medora, a small town in what's now North Dakota. And as he killed this last buffalo, he realized, oh, wait a minute, maybe that's not such a good idea. Maybe we ought to save it. And he saw that the resources of the West, which almost everybody for 80 years had thought were infinite, really weren't infinite. He saw that there were whole forests that had been cut down and just left to erode away. And he thought something ought to be done about this. He saw some of the beautiful spots of the West and say, there is no higher use for what would become Yellowstone Park or Yosemite or Glacier National Forest than as something to appreciate the beauty of nature. And so we need to set this stuff aside. He said that the national forests and the national grasslands need to be better managed than they're being managed. Because when we leave them to the private sector, the problem is that nobody owns them. And there is what the economists call the tragedy of the commons, where if you don't own it, you have an incentive to use up the resources quickly as you can before somebody else does. And so somebody has to step in and regulate, put this under control. Otherwise, all of these resources will be lost and there won't be any left for future generations. And these conservationists, the whole idea of conservation is to conserve this stuff so that there will be something left for future generations.
Well, we're conserving oil, aren't we? We certainly found a bunch of that. Thanks well, that to was fracking. We're now oil independent. We've taken advantage of as much land as we possibly can to make ourselves fossil fuel independent. And how's that working out? How do you think that's going to work out in the future? Because all of a sudden we become fossil fuel independent in the world and start selling it and holding it. And we have a future with it. And now everybody on the left is against it. There's this giant war of climate change and everything else, and it's all because of fossil fuels. How is that going to work out?
It sort of depends on how many people become persuaded that climate change is an important issue. And at the moment, it hasn't moved the political dial very far. There are some groups that are fully convinced that this is the biggest problem facing the United States. And
there are a lot of people who believe that.
Right. And there are other people who say it's not. If and when it becomes an issue that can claim a majority in Congress with a sympathetic president, then this question of how quickly does the United States and other countries move from economies based on fossil fuels to something else, to something renewable or nuclear energy? So I mean, it's a question. I don't know the answer to this. I have enough trouble trying to explain what's already happened as a historian. I do not
That's
predict.
That's very funny, actually.
But once the future has happened, I tell you why that was inevitable.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back to the West thing for a minute, Chuck. I have a question here. We're, for any of us in our age groups, we grew up watching Westerns. And whether it was Wyatt Earp or Bat Masterson or whatever the case is.
Or Tom Mix back in the 20s and people like that. Right. Turn of the century.
How much of that stuff was rooted in any reality, or was it just a kernel of reality, you know, basically spun up? Or what do you see when you see an old show or an old movie like that?
Well, there certainly were cowboys, and there were dusty towns in the West. There were nowhere near the number of gunfights in the street or in the OK Corral that you would expect, because this wasn't a game. People did get killed, and so people tried to avoid these shootouts. In fact, my editor, when I was writing this book on the West, was pushing me to, well, tell us some more about gunfights. And I did the research on gunfights, and it's really hard to identify more than just a very small handful of gunfights that look anything like the ones that show up in every traditional Western movie. So one can argue this is simply what Hollywood does. It takes the most dramatic moments of something, and then everything is like that. It's basically the same if you watch any cop show today. You'd think cops engage in shootouts all the time and in high-speed chases. They don't.
Yeah, most of them never use their guns, period.
Right, right. But this is just part of the genre. The striking thing to me is how Westerns, I grew up with Westerns too, how they've essentially disappeared. And, you can't, even on old movie channels, you have a hard time finding Westerns.
Now, I can answer that question for you.
Pardon?
I can answer that question for you.
Okay.
The reason that Westerns have vanished, for the most part, as a movie genre, is because about 50% of the income from movies today is made outside of the United States. And it's too hard to sell an American Western to the rest of the world today.
Yeah. It certainly makes sense. Yeah.
You forget the spaghetti Westerns.
No, I'm talking about today, though. Not then.
Yeah.
You know, at one time, they sold very well internationally.
Right, because Europe loved the story of the West years ago. But today's generation of Europeans are not interested in stories of the American West.
And the Chinese certainly aren't. And the Koreans certainly aren't.
Chuck, I was talking with Kevin Sorbo, who's made a couple of Westerns. And Kevin says when they fund a Western, they have to build the model around all the income coming from the U.S. They can't, the lenders won't even allow them to add European money into the business model.
Well, these were very superficial stories at one time. Then you got Kevin Costner. What's a movie that he did about being
Dancing
stuck in the
Wolves?
I'm sorry, Dances with Wolves. You have things like that, which are far more story oriented, and they just happen to take place at that particular time. And the story is everything. I remember talking to one of my record producers in Nashville who was extremely successful. His name was Billy Sherrill. He wrote everything for George Jones and Tammy Wynette and on. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he said, I don't care how good you sing. I don't care what kind of range you have. It's the song. It's always the song. Mm-hmm. So it's the story. It's always the story, which is what Hollywood's lacking today is any imagination with stories. It just isn't working for them.
Yeah, but there have to be these cultural touchstones. So if you're going to make a movie, you have to be talking about things where the viewers coming into the theater or watching at home, they don't have to have everything explained to them. They sort of know
right.
what's going on. And 50 years ago, there were still people around who grew up on cowboys. I mean, there still are cowboys in parts of Texas.
But, I'm 78, so I remember.
Well, yeah. Roy Rogers is Chuck's cousin, or was Chuck's cousin.
He is. Okay. He was.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. And so it was part of the cultural inheritance. But it's not. We're really too far from that. When I end my book, Dreams of El Dorado, already people like Theodore Roosevelt and one of his friends, Owen Wister, the author who wrote The Virginian, and Frederick Remington, the artist and sculptor.
Right.
They knew that the money was in writing about or sculpting or painting cowboys precisely because the cowboys already were fading into memory. And there was this nostalgia that hung around cowboys. And this was in around 1910 or so. So that nostalgia remained as long as people who grew up with it lived into the 50s and 60s. But it's a little bit like, if you remember in the 1950s and 60s, there were lots of TV series set in World War II. And they were combat and McHale's Navy and Hogan's Hero. Sometimes they were played for laughs, sometimes they were played otherwise.
Right.
But that's because there are all these people who could identify. They knew what the story of World War II was. So you didn't have to tell them why there were these American prisoners in this prisoner of war camp in Germany somewhere. And it was the same thing. Those stories aren't being made anymore because nobody has those
records. What is the touchstone today?
It's a good question.
It is a good question. A lot of it has to do with sort of superheroes. I mean, the superheroes. And these are things that people grew up with comics.
I was going to say, but that's been around since the 20s and 30s, Superman. Right. And
But they can be reproduced. And so they're not rooted in history. So if we're looking at sort of historical background, well, for something like Downton Abbey, I mean, it's a different demographic, but that's still.
Late 1800s.
Yeah, or early 20th century. So,
right.
Yeah, but it's something or that 1900s. People recognize. And that's kind of playing to the subset that is really interested in the British monarchy.
But, so what's the touchstone for today? Is it the political? Is it political in 60s? That kind of stuff? I mean,
there's a little bit
I can't imagine that would play very well, but is that the kind of touchstone we have today?
I can't think of any theme within.
I mean, we've been through the Vietnam War and we've been through, you know, just
well, the movie. I mean, okay. I would say, for example, the wars in the Middle East. Iraq and Afghanistan. There are lots of spin-off and TV shows that are coming out of that. Mm-hmm. So we're watching the TV shows and the movies that are the equivalent of the 50s and 60s TV shows and movies about World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Afghanistan.
Stuff like Homeland and shows like that.
Right. Oh, and, yeah, and things like that where there is a little bit of harking back to the Cold War. Where, okay, so what was the one called? The Americans.
Right.
The embedded spies. So
that was a great series. I remember that.
So,
hey, Chuck, can I interrupt the show for a minute?
Absolutely not.
All right. Well, I've already done it.
You have. Chuck, have your way with me. Go ahead.
I want to thank people. We just opened up our own Patreon page. Now, to remind people what's going on here.
Tell me what that is, because I'm not really familiar with it. Is it like standing on a corner with a tin cup or what?
But digitally.
Okay. Wow, I've come a long way in the world.
So what it is, Chuck, as I've said before, Media Matters and the left has been going after all of our advertisers.
Oh, I know.
And they go after everybody's advertisers.
Right.
So we're not the only program doing this. The Rubin Report now does this. And what we've done is we've asked our listeners to
help. Really asking them to support us monetarily, right? To send some money in so we can stay on the air and actually talk to people every week.
Exactly.
And again, how embarrassing to have to resort to that. I'm so sorry, folks, but I mean, I guess we have to depend on you to actually keep us on the air, because the left is just so strong about, they just pillar these advertisements.
They want advertisers. Us gone.
We're going to have to be doing Relief Factor or something pretty soon.
Well, the bottom line is, you know, here's what it amounts to. Some of our audience has already gone to Patreon. The way you do it, Chuck, is you go to bluntforcetruth.com.
Yeah.
You'll see a button there for, you know, contribute at Patreon.
Mm-hmm.
You open up an account at Patreon, and some people, we get people that are, you know, giving $5 a month. We get people giving $20 a month. God bless them. I'm
That's
so
great.
Grateful
yeah,
for
no
that.
Kidding.
And I want people to understand this money goes to the staff. It's not going to Chuck and I.
No. It's to keep the program on the air, because it's not inexpensive, and we require a certain amount of staff in order to do it.
Right. So it's only to pay for the staff and for the cost of putting the show out. But folks, if you want to support the show, if you want to keep the show on the air, I would ask you to join up with other people that are. Go to bluntforcetruth.com, look for the Patreon button, click on, it'll take a minute. And we would just, you know, be very grateful. And we love the people that are supporting us. We love you for doing it. And we'll love the people that are about to.
Absolutely. This is what I do in my old age.
All right, let's get back to the show.
All right.
So the book is Dreams of El Dorado.
Folks, I can't wait to read this book. I'm really interested in it. I am sincerely.
I'm going to tell you. So Professor Brands has 30 books, I believe. And this
what do you
book,
do in your spare time?
I'm just trying to spit one out right now.
Oh, this my guy. God.
So Dreams of El Dorado, folks. If you go to the show notes at bluntforcetruth.com, we'll have links to Professor Brands and links to the book where you can find the book. You know what? I would love to bring you back. If we can bring you back, I would love to have a conversation with you about the founding fathers. And the reason I say that is because...
Well, they've been quoted so much in the last week.
Exactly. We have heard so many people channeling the founding fathers recently and what was in their minds. I think it would be great to get a historical view of who these people were. And because I think they've been, in some cases, I think that they were amazing. But in other cases, I think they've been created into larger-than-life superheroes now in some regard, and people don't have a real grasp on who they are or were.
I think that's definitely true. And they're a little bit like quoting the scriptures in that you can find something in their writings and sayings that suits every political view. So
Yeah, if you don't have the right context, exactly true. Yeah.
They're men for all seasons.
I mean, we have two political parties right now that are both claiming that they're the defenders of the Constitution and literally claiming they're the heirs of, you know, the rightful heirs of the founding fathers, and they can't both be right.
Well, since you use the phrase heirs of the founders, in fact, that's the title of my book before the one on
I didn't know that.
And it makes the point that you just made. So the heirs of the founders I identify as the second generation of American independence. And these are men like Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, and John Calhoun. And they all claimed that they were wrapping themselves in the mantle of the Constitution, the founding principles of the Republic. And they had diametrically opposed views. Views that were so opposed that they led to the Civil War. So the two sides in the Civil War, North and South, went to war, each side claiming it was defending the Constitution.
So, yeah. Chuck, maybe we need to bring Professor Brands back and do the Civil War first.
Well, that would be up to him if he would be gracious enough to do that. But I've certainly enjoyed today's show. It's been a great conversation. I thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing that with us. And we look forward to your new book. Say it again.
Dreams of El Dorado, A History of the American West.
And I would advise everybody to get a hold of that. It's on Amazon, I assume.
It is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, Chuck, you're going to go read that.
I am. I'm going to go to Amazon and put it on my iPad. And when I go on vacation to Anguilla, I'm going to read that book.
When are you going to?
First of January.
1st of January. Where is Anguilla? I don't even know.
It's somewhere down there in the ocean. I'm not sure where. You have to take a boat to get there. That's what it's appealing to me.
Excellent.
But anyway, Professor Bryans, thank you so much for coming on the show. We look forward to seeing you in the future. Hopefully we will. And very informative. And folks, if you enjoyed today's show, you can listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast One. We appreciate you listening, and we hope to see you next time on Blunt Force Truth.